Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? First of all, I want to thank the Intergroup for asking Nancy and I to come out here. And I'm delighted to be here, and I'm always happy to be at any kind of a celebration in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really believe that that's what sobriety is. It's just a continuous celebration of what we are and what we can become. And I don't know about you, but this is one drunk that is so glad to be going in the other direction. You know, when I look on all those years going the other way, it was real lonely. And I think alcoholism is a very lonely journey. And I would like to talk like I do most every time to those of you that got under a year or under 6 months, or you're in your first week, a young gentleman got his welcome in here, because you are at one of the most exciting moments in your life when you're just having the impact of Alcoholics Anonymous start to be felt in yourself. And we want you to stay, because you're entitled to a tremendous reward that may be just around the corner. And in spite of your own better judgment, which is a very dangerous thing to listen to, but I know that that's a... we always used to preface those things. Well, in my judgment, and my sponsor used to go, but you're still wearing a wristband from a nut ward. And I go, I know. I still wanted to have my judgment, you know. We don't like to give up our judgment of things. Even though it has brought us nothing but trouble, it seems like some referee of life will jump out and call a 15-yard penalty if you were to give up your judgment. Just to get a few things out of the way, I did, you know, some people keep track statistics and things like that. I came into AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964, so if I can hang loose for about another 3 weeks, I'll get my 20 years, and I'll be even with a couple other guys who we have dinner once a month, the class of 64, and I'm the junior member. The other guys already have 20 years, and they call me up all the time to inform me what it's like to have 20 years of sobriety. And I'm going to do that as soon as I get there with several other people. And I did come into AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964, and I have not been drunk since my first meeting, and I owe it all to not drinking. That is bottom line. That's how you not get drunk. That's all there is. There isn't any steps involved in that. That's how you not get drunk, is you don't drink. Then we have a program which works the miracle. And the miracle is you get happy with not getting drunk. And I know if you're new, you're going, oh, this guy doesn't understand me, or he wouldn't be saying that I'm going to get happy with not getting drunk. But AA is, in my opinion, an endless journey of being wrong. You know what I mean? This is how you get happy, is finding something else you're wrong about and changing your mind. Which sounds very funny in the telling, but I have yet to look forward to it. I still go through the same thing I went through when I changed my mind about being an alcoholic. It was a major issue. And I do not change my mind lightly. And yet I really believe that's what sobriety is. It's just an endless series of finding what else I've got the wrong information on, and through the inventory process, and discovering it, taking a look at it, gulping, hoping no one saw. Then they'd know I'm not perfect. And then changing. I found that when I'm having lousy days, it generally is, I've just discovered something I should do and change, and have decided not to. You know what I'm talking about? And I'm going through the day, and you're going, what's wrong? And I go, nothing.
What are you asking for?
Well, you just look something bothering you. It's not bothering me. There's nothing bothering me. Well, get off my back. And that's why we have home groups and sponsors and all of those things, and they come around. And if you're getting into a home group, you ought to walk in and get it right on the table, right up front, and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, you have my permission to stick your nose in my business at any time." Because that's what will save your life, is people sticking their nose in your business at any time, because the time you don't want them in there is when they should be there. And they go, "What's wrong? What's the matter? Sit down. We're going to drag it out of you." And they finally do, and we get fixed. And this, to me, is kind of what sobriety is. But it wasn't what sobriety was. I think when we first come in, it's impossible to see AA like you're going to see it a little bit later. I really believe that when we talk about the steps of the program, we talk about growth. It is very similar to climbing up a mountain. And the more you climb, the better the view. And the more you can see. And the more things look different. Once you get up a little bit higher and you look over the top of a tree and you go, "Oh, that's what that is. Well, I can only see part of that. It looked like it was a dinosaur. Now I see it's four cows, you know." And we just have half-truths, and as we grow in the program, we start getting perspective on things, and they look different. And as a result, the world changes because we're looking at it from a different spot than the gutter. Things look real low down there. I just don't want to leave the impression that I jumped into AA, for those of you that are new, and took to it like a duck takes to water. Very often I think you hear speakers standing up at the podium like this, or in discussion meetings anywhere, and we have a way, we have a vocabulary in Alcoholics Anonymous that can be very misleading if you're new. And you could feel out of place because you hear us saying things like, "Well, I was sober about 6 months to 8 months, somewhere in there, and I decided that I ought to take a fourth step and inventory my life and get into character building and get rid of my character defects." Now, let me translate that sentence for you so that you don't... What I just said was, at about 6 months, my sponsor told me he would break my arm if I didn't take a fourth step. And I prefer to say, I decided to take a fourth step. So, if you're new and you're sitting around and you're not motivated to grow spiritually and to get into character building, don't worry, somebody will motivate you if you stick around long enough. So you're in the right place. This is not a crowd of people who came by this way of life naturally. We came by this way of life in the most unnatural way, as a matter of fact. We fought this thing kicking and screaming. It is the fact that we have a fatal illness that is the common denominator here that has taken me, anyway, I don't know why I include everybody else, but it's taken me down a journey that I never would have chosen to go down. I just cannot imagine in my wildest dreams ever going where I've gone in AA if I didn't have to in the beginning. It was one of the greatest blessings that I've ever had, was being an alcoholic, because ironically it took me into a way of life that I cannot imagine myself going in there if I didn't have to. I had sort of a philosophy of life before I got to AA, if you could call it a philosophy. Stuff I picked up in men's rooms on the wall. Guys at the bar, you know, little ground rules, and I go, "That sounds good," you know, and you just say it, and people go, "Cool, that sounds good, that sounds good." And call that my philosophy of life, you know. And it didn't include this kind of a way of life at all, but rather it was sort of misbehave until you're 80, and then reform just as you're dying. That was sort of what I had in mind, and anybody who didn't do that really was out of it. They were out in left field. They didn't know where the action was. They weren't into living and getting all you could out of life. And so I just looked at people who weren't getting arrested regularly as the dullards of the world. And they were going to rust to death. And I just wasn't interested in that crowd. I wanted the action. I wanted to get moving and so on down. And so I really don't see how I ever would have come here through my own choice. My drinking is fairly typical for what they call primary alcoholics. That was in Marty Mann's primer on alcoholism. I remember reading that when I first came into AA, and she divided us into primary and secondary. And we're the crowd who drank socially for 10 or 11 minutes. And then, went over the line. So if that's your story why we came up with this label of primary alcoholic. And then there's this unlikely category who claim that they drank successfully for a number of years without any trouble, and then the filter broke and all hell started breaking loose at age 40. And they barely got in here in time. Well, I'm certainly not in that category because from the moment I drank, I was in trouble. And I never could drink safely. I never knew what was going to happen. Drinking was like playing Russian roulette. I found it adventuresome. Drinking reminded me of going to the library and checking out a thriller novel. You didn't know where it was going to take you. You didn't know who the characters were going to be, but you knew it was going to be exciting. You knew that. And I'd go into a package store and I'd get a bottle of rum and take it home and look at it. You know, you look at it, you can't tell a damn thing from the, can't tell a book by its cover and you can't tell a bottle by its label. And you can hold it up to a microscope, a spotlight, and smell it and shake it and listen to it. And you go, is there going to jail in here or not? You could find out was to drink it. And you remember that? And you go, God, sometimes you travel to Wiggins, Mississippi, and you'd go, what am I doing here? And you say, well, you should have got the bottle next to it. You would have ended up with the blonde. And you know, I like that. It was risky. Drinking was risky. It was like a real dangerous thing to do. I look back on some of the things I did. Right out of high school into college, I was a steeplejack to earn money. You know what I mean? All through college, I worked climbing chimneys and climbing up flagpoles and painting them and changing light bulbs on the top of radio towers and that kind of stuff. I liked risk. I think I was trying to be somebody. You know what I mean? I was trying to fix this thing inside of me. I always had this dialogue that went on like the commercial for Parquet Margarine and butter. You remember that thing, butter? And I go, margarine and butter, margarine. And I would go, I climbed to the top of this flagpole and I'm up here and I'm brave. And then the voice inside of me go, nobody. And then I go, God, I got to be somebody somewhere. And I'd go over and do something else. And the voice inside would just go, you're nobody. And at the end of the day, I'd sit down on the bed and I'd sit there and I'd go, am I somebody? And the voice would just come back and go, you're nobody. And it was just that inner voice always came back no matter what I did on the outside. Drinking seemed to fix that. Drinking shut that voice up. And when I drank, I was somebody. There was no doubt about it. It came from within. I had the feeling inside that I belonged, that I was at peace with the people around me. I was no longer inadequate. And I look back on it, and it was almost like the 14 promises of rum. I would intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me, you know, right out of the big book. And about the fourth drink, I would have answers, and I would know how to go over and ask people to dance. Fear of financial insecurity would leave. You only had half of the rent money, and you said, hell, I don't have it all. I've set up the bar, you know. Hey, I... I'm not worried about money. I don't need money. That's just a way of meeting people. And it was. It was a wonderful power in the chemical alcohol that gave me answers to life that were very, very important, because I wasn't getting them anywhere else. For some unknown reason, I mean, I don't know anything about why or where I missed base in the church, but I had a very good church upbringing, and I was a good little student and studied all those catechisms and listened to everything that was said, and I intellectually understood it, but none of it was connecting. And I found myself mostly frightened about the idea of a higher power, and don't remember anything being particularly supportive. I just had a great deal of apprehension about the idea of God, and he was going to get me someday, and I seemed to have no control over events that were occurring that were going to cause me problems after I died. I remember at age 13 in my particular neighborhood, there was almost an epidemic of impure thoughts that were going around. They were coming into my room, I know that. And I'm just going, man, this is racking up into about 4,000 years in purgatory just from the last month alone. You know, and so there was a constant scorekeeping going on, and I was just not doing that well. But nobody was sharing about this, and I certainly wasn't. Early on, I decided that this kind of stuff was best kept to yourself. The best way to handle life was alone. And this was reinforced reading comic books and television. Not television. I wish it was television when I was 13. Listening to radio shows and movies and the Tom Mix and the Lone Ranger and, you know, all of those things. And the real men, the real heroes, always handle things alone. I remember the great, the typical story was the little town out west and all the gangsters and bad people are tearing the town up, and they're going, why can't we get the Lone Ranger town, whoever lived out there, and they go, God, if we could only get him to come to our town. You remember that? And all the people, 100 of them, they couldn't handle this problem, and finally, the real man arrived, and there he was, the masked man. He had gloves on, and he always went in the bar first. You might remember that. Everybody got away from him, and he got a good load on in the bar. And then he went out and said, where's the trouble? And he walked right up to the trouble and blew the trouble right off the face of the earth, got on his horse and rode back off into the desert where he lived alone with an Indian. And the town people said, oh, I want to thank that man. You know, who was that masked man? He rode off there. And I remember going, now that is a real man. You know what I mean? That was sort of what I had in mind as a game plan for me. And I look back on it now and I go, why didn't I want to be one of the townsmen? Because they were just regular people. See, regular people never appealed to me as a role model. I knew about regular people. I heard about life. I cannot stand before you and tell you that people didn't explain life to me. I used to like to get up here and say, well, nobody ever told me how life worked. You know what I mean? Nobody ever told me the secret to life. Nobody ever gave me a hint of what life was about. I used to complain about that. I remember in grammar school, right off the bat, teachers used to get me and says, well, we're now entering this phase of life. It's called school. And this is how school works. They're going to tell you once, if you do this, you will do well in school, and you will be a success. For each subject, go home each night and study 5 minutes. That's for each subject. And if you will stay current and put in this short amount of time on a daily basis, you will not have to cram everything in at the last second and be pulling your hair out and always be behind and never have your papers ready. This is the game plan. And I remember going, okay, I'll buy that. I'll buy that that is a game plan. But it's up to me to test the limits of school. Somebody has to do the research you know, the clods can follow along, plodding away. 5 minutes, you know, following directions, no imagination, coming up, you know. But some of us are breaking new ground. We're more future-oriented. We're looking out there. We can improve on this stuff. You can't have the same answer go on forever. And so I was experimenting in what's the minimum amount you can study and still get a B? What's the minimum number of classes that you can attend at Yale University and graduate? I go back there now and they don't run. They're not really proud of that. What is the minimum number of nights you can spend home and keep a marriage together? This kind of research that you that you get into. What is the minimum you can do at work and not get fired? Somebody has to test these limits. In other words, I knew what the main road of life was. Everybody told me that. You just get right here on this highway, and this is how. You want to be a success? Let me show you. You get up in the morning, you go to your job, you do your work, you stay there all day, you get in your car, you go home to your house, and you stay with your family, and you be a nice father, and then the next day you get up and you go to work, and you do a nice job, and you come home into your own home and be a nice father, and life will be a success. And I went, that sounds terrible. You know what I'm saying? That sounded like, I mean, it just, that isn't what I saw and read about. Where's the excitement? Where is the, you know, the party? Where is the fun? That looked like something that you would do when you were real old and were incapable of doing anything else. So all I'm saying is I heard the message. I heard the message all along the way, and I saw people being successful at life, and I chose to ignore that because I was an alcoholic. I had another answer. I didn't realize that I had another answer, but I was listening to a different message. And it came from alcohol. And it came when I poured it in. And it gave me, and it says, you don't need any of that. We can give you peace of mind chemically. And I got all kinds of answers from alcohol and developed such a faith in the chemical alcohol that I draw the analogy at this point in my sobriety to my higher power. Alcoholism was a very spiritual thing. And I didn't realize it. But there was a great analogy between vodka and my relationship to vodka and the program. In other words, I was powerless over life at that time. I was a skinny, nervous teenager, and then I was a skinny, nervous 20-year-old, and then I was a skinny, nervous 30-year-old wandering around through life with a bunch of grown-ups out there wondering what was going on. You know, you ever have, those of you that are new, you ever have the feeling like you don't know what's going on and everybody else does and they know where to go and they know what groups to go over and talk to and they start conversations, oh, and they go, how do they know all that stuff to say? How do they just start talking like that? I mean, geez, I do that and everything comes out sideways, you know. It just seems to come natural. And I wondered, what was I missing that I didn't fit in there? And so I was sort of powerless over life. That was it. I just didn't have something that would give me all of this that I saw in other people. And I wasn't quite sure what it was that they had. But alcohol gave it to me. In a very literal sense, alcohol was a power base. It was like if I was some sort of a machine, this was my fuel. And I went in there, and it didn't matter what the problem was. Alcohol fixed it. I never diagnosed and analyzed my problem and said, let's see, is this one I ought to drink over? If I had a problem, I just drank. You know, and it didn't matter what the problem was. What's the problem? You're nervous? Let's see, should I drink or not? Hell, I had faith in alcohol. I just went, I wasn't nervous anymore. What's the problem? You need some energy? You're real tight? Drink. What's the problem? You can't make a decision? You're very confused? You're torn in the mind? Drink. About the fourth drink, boy, there was the answer, clear as a bell. You know, I just was able to make decisions. So what I had found in alcohol was a solution that was universal. It did not matter to me what the problem was. Alcohol was always what I went to first. I went to alcohol, got some down there, and I often think about that. I remember years ago talking about a Parker Brothers game. I don't know if I ever mentioned it out here the last time. But, you know, there's a lot of non-alcoholics in the world that are interested in alcoholism, and it's really hard to get inside the skin of an alcoholic and know what it would feel like to be an alcoholic. So we came up with this Parker Brothers game, and it's called So You Want to Be an Alcoholic? And it's like a little game board, and you have dice, and you move the little thing around there, and then somewhere along the way you draw a card, you know, like from the community chest or chance, like in the Monopoly game, and one of those cards will say something like, you will accompany these two gentlemen and do whatever they say. And then you get blindfolded and you're taken on an airplane, spun around 100,000 times, taken up into a hotel room, stripped down to just your underwear. You're left with $1.40. The hotel bill is $612. And you have to be, after you find out where you are, in New York City in 30 hours for the most important job interview of your life. One last thing. You have to take these two thumbtacks and punch them into the palm of your hand and leave them there at all times and pretend nothing's wrong. Ready, get set, go! And you see, this particular puzzle would be real easy for the alcoholic because we've left the $1.40. Now, this game is real old. We obviously have to change it to whatever drinks are today. I've lost touch. But we left them the price of a drink. And obviously, the first thing you do in a situation like that, go get a drink. Because if you get a drink, that will lead you to the answer of how to get out of this situation. And so that was my relationship to alcohol. Now, what I had to do, and it was, I don't know how I got there. I don't know why I became an alcoholic. It's really irrelevant. I still, to this day, my sobriety does not depend on me figuring out why I became an alcoholic. It's sort of, if I want to write a book, I could maybe delve into it. But I don't need to know that for any particular useful reason. But when I first came into AA, I thought that would be the most important thing I could find out, is why did this happen to me? And I guess the only answer I can come up with now is because I happened to be there. You know, there wasn't any particular reason that it happened to me. I was lucky. In order to earn drinking money, I joined the Marine Corps and became a fighter pilot, and I flew for the Marine Corps for 11, 12 years, and the drinking progressed right on schedule. I got married, had 6 kids in the 7 years. Traveled all around the world. The Marine Corps transfers people at least once a year. You just get your stuff unpacked and you're packed up again. It was, you know, a very active life. There was a lot of excitement overseas and teaching flying and so on down. Eventually, my drinking got so bad that I started experiencing strange problems flying. I started having withdrawal symptoms in the airplane, and I would get loss of vision and, you know, trembling hands and all of these things. And so after great and I carried that on for at least 4 more months after that started happening. I remember one time down in Cherry Point, North Carolina, I was flying Crusaders, and I spent 40 minutes flying around with one hand on the ejection seat because I thought I was going to lose consciousness. You know what I mean? I just said, well, you're going out. And then I had this theory. Only alcoholics can get into problems like this. You know what I mean? Let's see. Here's the answer to this problem. In the government's $1 million airplane, I've got the ejection seat, and I'm going, let's see, if I pass out, I'll probably fall this way, and I go out, you know. And I think if I had come down and shared that with the commanding officer, he would not have believed me. You know what I mean? Unless he was an alcoholic, then he would have said, well, we got two problems. When you get the answer to that, let me know. I do that a lot myself. But at any rate, it did get to where I did not trust the pilot of the plane I was in. There was that part of me that realized that I didn't know what was going on some of the time. And so I turned myself into the flight surgeons. They sent me down to Florida, and I went through 3 weeks of close scrutiny as to what could be causing all these problems. And this is back in the dark ages before they had alcoholism as an illness in the Navy. And if they didn't have it, you couldn't have it. So no matter what it was, it had to be diagnosed as something else. And at that point in time, all of my problems were left up to a psychiatrist. They could find nothing physically wrong. They saw the high blood pressure, the trembling hands, the vision that was going all over the place. And so they left it up to the psychiatrist, and my diagnosis was written up as childhood fear of airplanes. That's how it was diagnosed, and obviously I wasn't helping in the diagnosis. I was lying about the drinking, and I was terrified at that moment in time. I'll tell you, those wings were so important. At least with those on, I was somebody, you know what I mean? Now they're going to take them away, and it just was killing me, but there was no way that I could fight this. I did not have anything inside of me that gave me any value. I was only what I did. I was only what you said I was. And I needed you to keep telling me that I was somebody. Because if you stopped, an event stopped, I was nobody. Because unless you're spiritual, you're nobody. That's the only thing that fixes that. That's the big jackpot in AA. We had misdiagnosed what our problem was. We had a spiritual problem. We're trying to fix it with material and physical things. And alcohol is close to that higher power. And it was going down there and giving the illusion that somehow we were on to a fix. And it's a great name for it, a fix, because it was fixing this particular problem. But at any rate, losing this big macho thing and not being... And that just was debilitating. I came back, and just to show you, I wasn't the only one who had a problem. The Marine Corps, in deciding what to do with a guy who couldn't find his way out of an airplane and shaken and eyes crossed and everything, made me an air traffic controller. And that's what I did in the last year of my drinking was... work on radar scopes and bring airplanes in when the weather was so bad that they couldn't see the runway. So, fortunately, there aren't any horror stories, no crashes, no nothing like that, but that was what I was doing. And there came an end to all of this in a career school in Quantico, Virginia, where I was somehow had been sent on orders. You know, you're moving your way up through the ranks. This is a very important school to attend. And while at the school, I had a convulsion, a seizure in the middle of a class where I just stood up and bit my tongue and fell on the floor. We finally had something serious enough that it could no longer be denied by everybody around us. And I was carried off to the Bethesda Naval Hospital to find out what caused the seizure. And I was there about a week, up in the tower where all of the dignitaries of this country are sent when they have problems. And about a week into my stay up there in the fancy part of the hospital, I went into the DTs. And that let the cat out of the bag conclusively as to what had caused the convulsion. And I was put in a straitjacket and put back in the nut ward, where I stayed for 6 months. Well, I'll tell you, well, they didn't have an alcohol program. They just threw you in with the all the people that have other problems. And there we sat while they diagnosed us and analyzed us and got the psychiatrist, and we went to clay class, and we sat around and talked about alcoholism, and we did all these things. And months went by, and I just was just lost in this whole morass of analyzing and figuring what was going on. And somewhere in the middle of all of this, Alcoholics Anonymous appeared briefly in the hospital. They talked the medical director into allowing them to come in and bring a meeting or so. And that's how I got to my first AA meeting. A corpsman came into the nut ward and said, "All drunks fall in. Forward march," and I was at a meeting, and I didn't want to be there. And I thought it was totally unfair to be marched into a meeting and be there against your will and all of this. And come to find out, that's how just about everybody gets to AA, is against their own better judgment. You know what I mean? And my reaction was not very good. I listened to the speakers and went up afterwards and told them they had a wonderful program. If I ever ran into a guy with a drinking problem, I'd send him around. I was still rationalizing. I still didn't see where it was me. Just a lot of lousy, bad breaks. And the speaker gave me my first taste of the truth as we learn it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. He just walked right up to me and started poking me in the chest, and he asked me a very tough question. He said, "Let me ask you something. Which one of us is going to go out and get in his car and drive on home to his family? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on, go back over to that elevator, go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? Now, which one are you?" And I remember going, "I just met this guy." I've seen rude treatment before, but this... And I resented, and as soon as I got out of there, 3 months later, I got drunk right at him. Built right up. And that lasted for about 3 days as an outpatient in the nut ward, drinking, bringing vodka back in, and I knew they were going to catch me. And so I came up with a plan. When I was at home down in Quantico, I said, "I know what I'm going to do. They're always preaching AA. I'm going to join AA over the weekend, get a membership card, real AA, not the one that was in the hospital. And then when I show up Monday, all screwed up, I'm going to say, 'I joined AA and look what happened.' I was going to blame it on AA that I had gotten drunk." The problem was I hadn't counted on my sponsor. He screwed this plan up terribly because I did make this phone call and this giant arrived at my door. And he just kind of went boom, 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 you know, and I went over and opened the door. And he was just filling the whole door frame. And I remember sort of looking, and I went, "Boy, we got trouble here. I can see that." And he just said, "My name is Bill. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen." We have a problem here. And he came in the house and he said, "Here's the literature. Where's your wife? You want to start talking to my wife? Oh, this is the plan. Oh, he's that bad. Oh, in the nut ward, see, she let everything out. You know what I mean? Just, oh." All I wanted was some literature. And he just started, "Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to a Manassas meeting tonight, and there's a meeting in College Park tomorrow night, and we'll go up to Washington the next night, and Friday night we'll go over here, and Saturday night we'll go over here." And I'm going, "What the hell's he talking about?" You know, blah, 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 blah. And we went to a meeting that night. It was a group anniversary. It was a big celebration. No, not as big as this, but it was one of these special nights where they had food afterwards and followed by a square dance. And it lasted 5 hours. So that when the meeting ended, I had around 13 hours of sobriety. And on the way back in the car, he starts talking about, "And then we'll go here next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Thursday, Friday," you know, and I have no way of knowing that all AA meetings aren't 5 hours long. And I knew I had to get rid of this guy, and I had my plan for him. I had the 6 kids' birthdays were coming up one day, and you know, good father, I had to be there. And then it was the anniversary, my birthday, my wife's birthday, my parents were coming down, and I had this speech, and I knew if I didn't get rid of him that night, I might never get rid of him. You know, I had that premonition. I was right. I have never gotten rid of that guy. He is still in Virginia. And he's still Bill, and he's still big, and I still, if he called up and said, "I'm," I would do it. But we got back to my house, and I got out of the car, and I walked around and stuck my head in the door, and he looked and knew I wanted to say something, and I started this long spiel about how I would not be able to go. And you remember when you got about 14 hours of sobriety, and you've had DTs and convulsions, and you've been bad, bad drunk for a long, long time? There's problems in the system. Information leaves the brain for the mouth. I don't know where the hell it goes. I think it goes down to your feet. It doesn't go like it today. I think now, and I go, and come right out, and you hear me talking. It's working real good. But back in those days, you'd go, look all around. So I was standing there with my finger and was, you know, going, it was, he knew I was trying to say something, but I don't know where the hell all that information went. I just was there. And he watched for a few minutes, and finally he just said, "You don't take a drink, and I'm going to pick you up tomorrow night at 7:30. Gone. And I guess his taillights were just going out of sight when I started, "I won't be able to go to that meeting tomorrow. I have a birthday party and an anniversary." And I went through the whole speech out in the road in front of the house, and I'm sure my family was looking out the window going, "Oh, that damn AA isn't working either." Looking, carrying on a conversation, nobody there. And here it is, almost 20 years later, and that was the last day that I had a drink. And a lot of things have happened. And I'll just spend the rest of the time I got here telling you what happened. The most important thing that happened was God. That's the most important thing that happened. That I'll get that out of the way. This is a spiritual program. It's not a religious program. I got a higher power. I got the higher power I was supposed to have all along. It was there. I kind of had a feeling that it was there. We're given, if you're new, probably you said you were enjoying this talk till I got to that line. You were going, "This guy's all right. I like him. He's all right." Then I went, "And then I found God." And you went, "Well, that's it. I thought I liked the guy." Up till then, he was all right. Forget it. Well, let me tell you about alcoholism, and maybe you can do what I did with regard to this God stuff. Alcoholism, in my judgment, is a fatal illness, and you're going to die an alcoholic death unless some higher power saves you. That's what alcoholism is. And there isn't any human power. There's no alternative to this program. There isn't anything with the... And that's why AA parades its results in front of you so that you can see the results. You don't have to take any of this on faith. You get to see it. At every AA meeting you go to, it's a huge show-and-tell operation. We just drag everybody up here. We go, "Hi, I'm Mary." And you're looking for one that's just like you. "That one's just like me." So now we know it can work for you. But there's a big thing that has to happen before it can work for you. And it's drag everybody up here. We go, "Hi, I'm Mary." And you're looking for one that's just like you. "That one's just like me." So now we know it can work for you. But there's a big thing that has to happen before it can work for you. And it's very close to the Queen Mary doing a 180 in the Atlantic. It's called you changing your mind. Me? I'm not into changing my mind. It's obvious. It's obvious. And so it works something like this. I really think that we are, in our early stages, we ought to have some kind of a machine where we can take everybody in about their first month of sobriety, and we go all the way up to the sobriety tower. You know, the parachute towers that they have in the military? I remember they pushed me out of that thing. It scared the hell out of me. But I had a rope tied on my back, and you jump, and the rope snares you just before you hit the ground. It's supposed to feel like a parachute, only in this one, there'd be no rope. No, just take everybody up there in the first month of sobriety and take them about 150 feet up and throw them off. And then this big hand would be hidden, and it would come out about 8 feet from the ground. Just about, and grab you at the last second. Excuse me, sir, we're conducting a survey. Do you believe in God? Even the most macho wouldn't look bad changing his mind there. You know what I mean? Even your best friends would go, yeah, I would have changed my mind there too. What have you got to lose? If there isn't one, splat. Let's hope you're wrong. Well, our first step of Alcoholics Anonymous says exactly that. If you're powerless over alcohol, your life's unmanageable, that's where you are. You're 8 feet from the concrete, only it hasn't been explained to you yet. That first step should scare the hell out of you when they suddenly pull the rug out and go, I am. And you go, what about this higher power thing? And you go, I don't believe in a higher power, but I do believe that I need one. And that's all you need. That's all you have to do is open that mind that far to recognize that your position is such that you need a higher power or it's over. That's all you need. You don't have to understand what this higher power is. I have no idea what the higher power is. I know what happens when I allowed it into my life because of an open mind, when I changed my mind and said, okay, if there's a higher power, help. Help arrived. And now I believe. I believe because of the changes and because of all the wonderful things that have come into my life by simply changing my stupid mind. And I look back, you know, it's kind of humorous. You imagine, here's the alcoholic, here's Sandy down here about 17 years ago going, okay, there can be a God. I can see God up there. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Right on. Now I can really get going up here. Guy really let me in. But that's the power that we have. We have the power. This is what I think free will is all about. We have the power to refuse all help. That's the power we've been given. The power to refuse all that, all help. We can refuse our home group, our family, the people who love us. We can block out every bit of help there is in the world, and then we run around claiming there's no help in the world. Because I haven't got any. Nobody ever helped me. I have the power to block it out, and then I claim there isn't any. I have the power to block out a higher power, and then I can run around claiming there isn't one. And there wasn't one in my life because my alcoholism, my character defects, my self-centeredness, my pride, my ego blocked out all of this. And of course, I wasn't being a smart aleck about it, but based on my information, there wasn't any of this stuff. There was no love in the world. There wasn't any of this people helping each other out. There wasn't sharing. There wasn't any of this. So I wasn't making it up. This was my real experience. The problem was I was wrong. That's the problem. As my friend Charlie Bruton used to say, it isn't the things that you don't know that kill you. It's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. That's what I had. I knew a whole bunch of things that weren't true. And if you're new, you know for sure a whole bunch of things that aren't true. And you're going to have to trust the people in this program to take you down a journey. And they're going to take you down these 12 steps. And these 12 steps are going to be your game plan for living. It's going to be your navigation system. There is such a thing as a higher power. You get plugged into a higher power, you can be guided through your daily life. You can receive intuitive guidance about how to behave, where to go. You wonder about how to spontaneously talk and all this. It can come from a new power source, just like it used to come from vodka. You took vodka on the faith of the other people who drank before you. You remember smelling it, going, this stuff's going to make me feel good, know how to talk, it doesn't look like it, drink it. And we drank it. We didn't sit there waiting around. But we fight this program, and it's normal to fight it. It's normal to fight the choice they talk about in the big book. And it just reminds me of, remember the Jack Benny, the comedian? I remember doing this once, and I forget that some people aren't old enough to remember Jack Benny, but he was the world's biggest tightwad. And he had his great radio show, and one of the funniest moments that ever occurred on that show, you heard footsteps. And it was just Jack Benny was walking down a hallway, and all of a sudden a stick-up man came out and said, your money or your life? And there was this long silence. and the audience started laughing, and there was more silence, and the audience laughed even more, and there was more silence. And finally, the stick-up man said, "Well?" And Benny said, "I'm thinking." And we are all left with something in our big book that Bill Wilson has a great sense of humor. You know, Bill, when he writes in the 12 and 12 in the big book, every time he teaches us a new principle, the immediate thing he follows it with is the reasons we're not going to do it. You know what I mean? And then he overcomes all the objections. And he writes this wonderful line in either, I think it's the second step or the third step. It says, "The choice to live on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death is not always an easy one." Can you imagine us? Now, everybody in the room here, we're going, "Ah, we think that's the funniest damn thing in the world." You go down to your office and share that. You go down to your office and tell them, "You know, one of the biggest things I had to decide..." "What?" And gather the fellow worker. "I had to decide whether to live on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death." They would look at you. "What?" "Well, how did you finally reach your conclusion?" "I researched how bad an alcoholic death would be and reluctantly chose the former." So kicking and screaming, we are led to this path that was placed us when we were 6 years old. Here are some spiritual principles. Why don't you follow us down this path? Everything that is yours will come to you if you will take this journey. Say, "Where's the guarantee?" There's no guarantee. There's faith. You just have to do it a day at a time, and it will come to you. And this is what the AA journey is. It's going to take you into the best of you. It's going to find the good in you and mine it and dig it out and make it grow. And you're going to find all of your previous principles start falling away as you get interested in service, as you get interested in being useful with other people, as you find out that the real values in life are living in harmony with all kinds of people around you, the wonderful skill of being able to understand rather than be understood, to take the entire prayer frame, St. Francis, and understand why that's so valuable as a daily way of living. And when we move through this, we will find that none of our problems are really solved or understood. They are simply removed. Our alcoholism never gets figured out. It just gets lifted away. As the 10th step says in the big book, what we have is a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. As long as I try to work the solution, the higher power says, "Oh, you got a drinking problem? Let me hold it for you while you're working the steps." "Where are you going?" "Oh, going over to the massage parlors tonight? Take your drinking problem with you. I'm busy." Anytime you see, and so I go, "Wait a minute. All I wanted to do was stop drinking. I don't want to become a saint. I just came in here to stop drinking. I want to get rid of all my character defects. I don't want to. Isn't there some other kind of help available?" See what I mean? We don't learn how to almost get sober. It's all the way. It's no drinking. None, none, none. None at all. It's sort of an extreme situation. The problem that we have, the only help that's available is perfect help. You cannot pray to be semi-honest. You got to do that alone. "God, I got better keep you out of this. You're going to go overboard. This is a business deal. I'll rip this guy off here and I'll do that." And God says, "Oh, here's your drinking problem back." We either take the whole package or none. It's a hell of a decision. You look at that in the 6th and 7th step and you go, "What did I sign up for?" And it looks like the worst for us. You know what I mean? Everything against my better judgment to get into character building. This is also against my better judgment. I remember worrying about getting too good for the neighborhood. What if I became a real nice guy living with all these jerks? It'll put pressure on them. I still don't think I'm as good as they are. If I used to worry about that, my self-centeredness would cause me to worry about that. It was an amazing phenomenon to grow in sobriety. The last thing I want to say is something that I saw in a Beatles song when John Lennon died. And I was never a big fan of them. I was too drunk all the time. And the song had to do with watching the wheels go by. And it talks about, you know, there's no problems in life, only solutions. There's no problems in life, only solutions. My problem was I focused on the problems all the time. I talked endlessly about problems. And what the program says, let's stop doing that and focus on the solution. Let's walk down the 12 steps of sobriety a day at a time, and at the end of the day, then let's look at the problems. And very often, they're gone. They just aren't there anymore because I was working on the solution. I was taken to a place where the problems aren't that important anymore. I asked my higher power for some help, and at the end of the day, he said, hey, you did pretty good, this and that. I look back, and the stuff that was so important just isn't. So the focus of the program is on the solution. It's very hard to remember that. In closing, I'll tell you one story about my own experience with the solution versus the problem. In sobriety, and I say this for the benefit of the new people, you're going to run into some unfair deals. And just in case there's somebody out here who keeps track of whether things are fair. And I was sober about 2 years, and I got thrown out of the Marine Corps. Went to a meeting every night for 2 years and got thrown out of the Marine Corps. That was unfair. And I went to a discussion meeting. Did you ever go to a discussion meeting? And the leader says, anybody got a topic? Nobody says anything, so then he comes up with a topic. And on that particular night, I said, yes, I want to be, raise my hand, I want to be heard. So I raised my hand, and I said, I got thrown out of the Marine Corps, I don't have any money, I don't have a job, I don't have a career, and whining and self-pity. I was really looking for a job. And I knew some of the people in the group were, you know, owned big companies, and they'd go, oh, this guy, let's help him out. That was obviously unfair. And the first guy there said, thrown out of the Marine Corps, huh? Serenity prayer. Serenity prayer? Next guy said, thrown out of the Marine Corps, four-step inventory. Do a four-step inventory. That's what you got, do an inventory. Next guy said, prayer St. Francis. Prayer of St. Francis, out of the 11th step. The last guy said, you got to get involved helping others. I went home that night and I said, I think I'll change groups. Those people did not hear one word I said. They just didn't relate to me with that. So one thing I didn't do for a number of years was raise my hand with a problem in an AA group. But 7 or 8 years later, I was in the middle of a very bad divorce situation, and all the pain, and the long marriage ending, and all those kids and other people, and all that. So I decided that was worth going to the meeting, and I had to share that. I was just busting out all over the place. Marriage to other people, unfair to kids, I'll never see them, they hate me, I'm a father. Guy said, oh, marriage breaking up, divorce, serenity prayer. Next guy over here says, all right, now you got to get a four-step, man. You're all screwed up. You better do a four-step inventory. I can tell you that right now, four-step inventory. Next guy over here, prayer St. Francis. You better get that, prayer St. Francis, the 11th step. Last guy, you better find somebody in trouble and help them. And probably about 5 years later, having financial problems. I was in the real estate business, and the market got real tight, the money market, and I'm in the bankruptcy and all of those things. Now I am really upset. And I went back there with money problems. What do you do? No money, no money. I figured there'd be two collections that night, you know, that go around the room. No money. Hey, man, 15 years of sobriety. No money, no money, no money, no money. Oh, no money? Serenity prayer. You got to take a four-step inventory. You're all bent out of shape over having no money. Prayer of St. Francis, better to understand than be understood. I'm going, you're out of your mind. Go find somebody with a problem and help them. So if AA, if you're new, and as you march through sobriety, if AA sounds like a broken record, it is. Work on the solution. Work on the solution. That's what this is. It is a huge answer. Your life is in the answer. stay in the answer, and you'll be amazed where the problems go. They'll be in the hands of a power that loves you. They'll be in the hands of someone that can manage all of those things. And you will be available for everything that's in store for you. You new person, you have no idea what a wonderful person you are. You have no idea what a diamond is inside of you. You are so lovable, you are so creative, there's just some stuff blocking it. And the program's going to unlock it. It's going to show you the real treasures of your life. And you're going to be so damn happy you won't be able to stand it. Thanks a lot.